Yes, sir.
You mentioned just a second ago about improvements in productivity. Mm-hmm. And so could you comment on your thoughts with regards to the so-called potential jobless recovery?
Well, first, and this is partly based upon the question in the back, by the way, was so I'll make sure everybody hears, is I commented on productivity. Would I comment on the phrase that's used, the so-called jobless recovery? Well, first, we've heard from a number of business people over the last 2 to 2.5 years that companies used the recession for learning. And in many cases, they found that they could operate, they could produce the same or equivalent revenues, the same or equivalent output with fewer workers. So there was a lot of work done in companies during the recession to improve their productivity. Much of the equipment and software investing that's taken place over the last 2 years, we believe, has been productivity-oriented. That is essentially to get more out of the existing workforce. So as companies responded to the recession and financial crisis by dropping employment, they have not been hiring back at the same pace. It's not a one-for-one rebound as one would hope. And that's because there have been substantial productivity gains achieved by companies during this period. Employment is now beginning to come back. As I said earlier, we talked to a lot of people across the Southeast. Here are some of the anecdotal pictures that we get that relate to productivity and employment. Another thing companies learned is that they could upgrade their standards and their requirements for employees. So many companies have redefined jobs to require a higher level of skills. An example of that, a quite interesting one, I think, is the CEO of AutoNation is on our board down in Miami, and he related his experience of taking an auto salesperson pre-recession and requiring now of that salesperson the ability to negotiate the warranty, to walk the documents through the whole process so that it's really a beginning to end single person who's handling the transaction as opposed to the handoff that used to occur. So a number of companies have sort of upgraded their workforce and their requirement. And this makes it difficult for some people who are out of work to come back because the standards have been raised. Yes, sir.
There will be two ways to tighten federal policy. One is short-term rates with the federal rate. The other will be to sell treasuries. What are the considerations? What are the advantages and disadvantages of working on either of these levers?
The question is there are two basic ways to tighten monetary policy. One would be to raise rates through raising the federal funds target rate, and the second would be to sell treasuries, essentially to shrink the balance sheet. And the question is, what are the pros and cons or relative advantages of those two? Well, in some respects, they have a similar effect, and they would have that effect on longer-term interest rates, that is, the interest rates that consumers and businesses actually incur when they borrow in the economy, and to some extent, therefore, higher interest rates in the case of either driven by a rise of the Fed funds rate target or by the selling of treasuries would discourage on the margin borrowing. Although I would say that almost in any scenario, interest rates will remain historically low. Pros and cons of that. Well, first, the conventional, traditional approach to monetary policy, at least over the last couple of decades, has been built around movements in interest rates. The federal funds rate target today cannot go any lower. It's at what we call the zero lower bound. So the only direction it could go is up. So if we reverse policy, clearly we would raise that. The pros of that is that that's essentially a very well-understood, very well-oiled mechanism of doing that. What we do is we announce a rise of the target rate, and then we try to manage in the money markets the supply and demand of overnight bank reserves to hit that rate. The federal funds rate is the rate at which banks lend to each other overnight to meet their reserve requirements. So what's really good and easy about that, relatively speaking, is that it's a very known quantity as a mechanism for tightening policy. The challenge that's related to that mechanism is the fact that prior to the financial crisis and prior to the recession, the amount of excess reserves that would constitute the market for the federal funds rate was roughly $30 to $50 billion. Today that number is $1.7 trillion. So the bank reserves that sit on the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve have grown dramatically during this period. So we are going to have to shrink those reserves to a level in which a market mechanism that sets that federal funds rate actually will work. And it is a supply and demand. It's a market. It's a true market rate. So that's the challenge related to that. Turning to the selling of treasuries, it's a timing question to some extent. Obviously, when we start to shrink the balance sheet, we'll also be shrinking the excess reserves. So you can view those two things as, in a way, working together. We want to do that in a way that the markets understand in advance. And as you probably have observed, our programs of asset purchases have been well explained in advance, including the monthly amount that we're going to purchase. So turning in the other direction, where we are trying to bring down the scale of the balance sheet, we would have to explain that well in advance in order not to disrupt markets and to not give incorrect guidance to markets. And then you simply have the sheer magnitude of conceivably, at least in one scenario, going from $1.7 trillion to $30 to $50 billion is a long way to get there, and we're going to have to do that in a very, in a very reasoned, methodical, and non-market-disrupting way. So I hope that gives you a sense of how we're weighing those two mechanisms for the eventual tightening of policy. Long-winded, I'm sorry about that. The professor comes out in me, yes, sir.
Could you give some background on your thoughts on potential wage inflation?
The question for those of you in the back is, would I provide thoughts on the possibilities of wage inflation? No indication to speak of yet. Obviously, with 8.8% unemployment, and that's come down pretty nicely, but still at a very high level. Looking at the labor markets, we have a big gap between what we would call something close to full employment and where we are today. Anecdotally, talking to business people, and this is a question that we ask practically every cycle, every 6 weeks or so, we're hearing no indication of wage pressures to speak of, whether that's organized labor or at-will employees. So at the moment, there is simply no indication or little indication, except in small pockets, of any pressure on wages. It is a very important question, and for that reason, I thank you for asking it, because the longer-term concern, of course, is getting into a cycle in which businesses and employers institutionalize rises in wages in order to accommodate for price rises. When I was a banker in the early 80s, which was a period of inflation, I remember very clearly, because I was in a management position at the time, that we were giving raises at 10 to 12% in order to keep our people whole. That's what you have to do. When we institutionalize that wage inflation, then you have something going that really is serious, broad-based inflation that clearly the central bank would have to deal with. So your question gets at a a really critical a critical aspect of the broad inflation or price question. Thank you. Yes, sir. Everybody up front gets the questions here.
Now the massive deficits we're running at in government right now eventually going to affect Fed policy.
Question for those of you in the back is the dreaded question that we get these days, and that is, how are the massive deficits and the debt, that is the fiscal side of the government finance or the fiscal side of the picture, going to ultimately affect monetary policy? It gives me an opportunity to emphasize, and particularly for the students in the back of the room, the distinction between monetary and fiscal policy. We are the monetary policy folks at the Fed, and Congress and the administration deal with fiscal policy. Historically, we have not, that is, central bankers, the Fed officials, have not, except in very general terms, waded into any debates about fiscal policy. It is one of the ways that we try to ensure that we have central bank independence to conduct monetary policy independent of short-term political influence. And I would say it's as important today as it has been over the years. So let me therefore give you a kind of high-level response to your question. I'm not going to get into the deliberations that were occurring yesterday or today in trying to get a resolution. That's a matter for Congress. First, the fiscal adjustment that the country is bound to go through in one way or another clearly is going to be a major force in the economy. And for that reason, we, as central bankers, are very concerned and interested that that process be first tackled and secondly that it go as well as it possibly can go. We operate, as I said, in the formulation of monetary policy quite independent of the fiscal side. And there is a cardinal sin, in effect, of central banking that looms out there as something that's on the minds of financial markets and the public in general, and that is the prospect of monetization of the debt. Monetization of the debt that is issued and generated by continuing deficits. If we, the central bank, were to take action to try to alleviate the pressure of the debt by printing money and then buying the debt with the intent of, in effect, inflating our way out of the burden of debt as a society, as a country, then we certainly would have, in my mind, and these are my personal views, failed in our responsibility. My colleagues and I have repeatedly, I think, indicated that we have no intention of essentially using monetary policy as a way of reversing the pressures of the deficits and debt. Consequently, the folks that are responsible for that, the administration and Congress people on Capitol Hill, have to, as they are, tackle these issues. It is not going to be alleviated, in my opinion, it's not going to be alleviated by monetary policy. Now, we can say never, and you never know exactly what the exact circumstances would be at any given time, but as a principle, the denial of monetization to the fiscal side, I consider a very important principle. Hope that answers your question.
Yes,
Mike.
Same question, Dennis. Do you have an opinion as to whether it's a revenue problem or an expenditure problem?
Question in the back of the room, and I repeat the question so I have time to think about the answer, is whether it's a revenue problem or expenditure problem. You're drawing me too deeply into a controversial subject. I think clearly it is an expenditure problem, and there may be some revenue solutions as well. I don't think cutting discretionary expenses is going to solve the problem. Yes, Jenny.
This will be a less controversial question.
Jenny's job is to throw up a softball here.
Could you comment on the characteristics of the Sixth District Federal Reserve Bank, how it's important to the Board of Governors, the information that we can pull from the Southeast, how that can be useful?
All right. Jenny Banner's question is, could I comment on the characteristics of the 6th Federal Reserve District that the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta is responsible for and how it fits in the greater scheme of things in the Federal Reserve and how it may influence policy? And are you all staying for lunch? Because I like to talk about this a bit. First, let me tell you what the 6th Federal Reserve District constitutes. It's all of Georgia, Alabama, and Florida, about two-thirds of Mississippi, and about half of Louisiana, the southern half of Louisiana, and about three-quarters of Tennessee. The Memphis end, the western end of Tennessee, is in the St. Louis district. So, obvious question, why these strange lines? Well, they were drawn in 1913, so a little less than 100 years ago, and I presume they reflected some political and probably economic reality at the time. If you think of, for example, the St. Louis Fed having Memphis in its orbit, you know, you can imagine 100 years ago, the river economy, the riparian economy, was a more of an entity, and it made sense that Memphis be part of it. So it's the boundaries are not drawn exactly along state lines. The 6th District, as I described, is a major chunk of the U.S. economy. It's I'll just round off using whole states. It's about 41 or 42 million people and about 13% of GDP of the country. So it's quite substantial. It is also, interestingly, and this is, I would say, changed over the 30-some years that I've been associated with the Southeast. It is diversified now as an economy, and it pretty closely reflects the industrial constitution of the national economy overall. So when we talk to people in the Southeast to hear what they're experiencing, we believe we can extrapolate to the national economy. It's relevant to the national economy. That's not always true. For example, the condominium real estate problems in South Florida were somewhat unique to South Florida. They were not necessarily something that told us a lot about the national economy. But we get a lot of information that helps us understand what's going on in the national economy by talking to people in the Southeast. We have a now quite refined system of engaging the public in a cycle that is about 7 weeks in length. We have 8 Federal Open Market Committee meetings a year, so that's about 7 or 7.5 weeks between each meeting. And in that cycle, we are obviously following the data, both national and some regional data. And then as we get closer to the meeting, we start to engage our directors for their views on what's happening, and they in turn talk to a number of people in their set of contacts. We have several advisory councils that meet periodically, and we listen to what the advisory councils in various industries are telling us. We have some phone calls that I make personally and other people make, and we kind of bundle all that all up into a view of not only where the economy is, but where it's going. Policy is based on the outlook. That's a really important principle. It's not based on a static view of where we are today. That is because, among other reasons, monetary policy takes a lot of time to have effect. There's a lag between effect and policy. So we bundle all this up, and we basically come to a view in the last week before the meeting. And I, with my staff, draft 2 statements for the meeting in Washington. One statement is our sense of the economy and the outlook, where we think things are. And the second is what we think policy should be. And Every 7 weeks, I carry that to Washington and present those views along with my colleagues. And I would say I'm one of currently 17 participants in the FOMC, and we are all quite equal in our voice, really. Other than Chairman Bernanke, everyone else really has an equal chance to speak, and I would say, at least in theory, equal opportunity to influence policy. Yes, sir.
Are we having any international resistance to funding our debt at this point, and does that motivate the monetization of debt today because of our credit
The question is, do we have any sort of international restrictions related to or constraints related to the foreign ownership of our debt, and does that factor into our thinking of monetary policy? Does that capture the question? The basic fact set is important. About half of the national debt is held by non-residents, and a big chunk of that is held in official reserves of China and Japan, particularly, as well as some of the oil-producing countries. So that means that foreign governments hold the debt of the United States. And there's some concern that people have expressed that somehow the fact that China or Japan or a Middle East country being the creditor of the United States could at some stage have some influence on policy, or could simply stop buying the debt and stop accumulating it, as the case is now, and in that sense have a big negative effect on the economy. I'm aware of those concerns. I hate double negative sentences, but I don't take them unseriously. But I do think it's far-fetched that parties that have such a high exposure to U.S. debt are going to do anything to harm themselves. And consequently, it's my expectation that the governments that are major holders would act and will continue to act very responsibly about this. Now, they are diversifying their reserves and on the margin are trying to essentially spread their investments. So I don't want to speculate too much. We can't ignore over the longer term the reality that foreigners who own dollars or offshore entities that own dollars are investing them in our treasury bills and allowing our government to operate at a deficit. That may not always be 100% the case. And so, as a high-level, longer-term, and somewhat, second-order concern, I take it seriously, but I don't think it's an immediate concern. Thank you very much for your attention. It's been great to be with you here in Knoxville. Thank you.